Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to the art channel on the New Books Network. My name is Yakiri Oz today. When I had to choose under which category to place the interview with Ran Oron, our guest, I couldn't find a suitable one. It is not a book of poetry, nor is it a book about architecture. It is not an art book, but is also not literature. Anyone who chooses to pick up Ran's book, discover a work that re-examine what a book is. Ran Book is a journey of someone living between worlds, between Israel and the US. As a successful architect working in urban spaces, his book unfolds with a precise view from home to nature, to the lives of birds. Ran seeks to question, what is a home? What is language? What is drawing and what is text? And as someone who served as a helicopter navigator in the Israeli Air Force, the bird is also Ran's perspective, accustomed to observing the ground from the air. So our guest today, Ran Oron, was a helicopter navigator prior to studying architecture at the Cooper Union. For 2 decades, he was a design professor at Pratt Institute School of Architecture. And in 1996, he founded ROART, an architecture studio in New York City. Ran, welcome to the New Books Network.
Thank you.
Maybe we start by reading the two first paragraphs in your book.
Okay. In June, I began to draw the birds, lonely, even though I wasn't alone. I saw them return every spring, separately, from the forest along the equator. She from the south, he from the north. A couple. Prey birds that live all their life together, returning every year to the same nest. The Hebrew word for osprey is shalach. I am an architect. When I was younger, I was a helicopter navigator. This is a story of a nest.
Beginning that says so much. Normally, when I get a book, I got and there are some drawings. I think like 99% of the book are words, and 1%, you know, like a drawing here, a drawing there. You choose to do something totally different. I got a book and I read it the first time in half an hour, and then I read it again 2 weeks later, but it took me like 2-3 hours because the drawing took most of the time. You're an architect, as you say, and you rethink what a book is. So can you share with us a little bit about what happened, like, why did you choose to write this book, and what book is for you as an architect?
So first of all, the process of the book, I mean, it didn't start as a book, it started as drawings. And we're just a series of drawings, looking at the ospreys, at the family of ospreys just outside my house home in Connecticut. And I just started drawing them in my sketchbook. Later on, when I had a set of drawings, and I started showing it to people, friends of mine, poets, writers, told me you should write a story about it. And I started writing about it. Actually, one of the most difficult problems in making of the book was the decision where to put the text in relationship to the drawings. It felt to me that the drawings are the text and that the text is a kind of a drawing. It says, by the way, if you look at the book, you'll see that when you have a page of text, there's no drawings on the other side, or when you have drawings, there's no text on the other side. In other words, they are in a constant dialogue. that each of them is both a drawing and a text. I think it's also, you know, if you look at the quote in the first quote in the book, which is from The Art of Poetry by Borges, even the title where he talks about the art of poetry combines the two methods. One is art, one is poetry. Not that poetry is not art, but art for me was, I understood art more as a three-dimensional art. There's a way to combine both of them for me. As to writing on a book or writing a book as an architect, when I graduated from the Cooper Union in 1995, I had a show which was called Planes. It was a show of folding walls, walls that fold in infinite ways. Dori Ashton, who was my dear and beloved mentor, who I miss very much, wrote an article about it and called it On Another Plane. And in the article, she described the walls that I'm making. She said they're not retaining walls, but they're containing walls. In that sense, I feel that a book is full of containing walls. The idea that you actually can open a book and go through the pages reminded me of the concept that actually drove this exhibition or the project, was that we as human beings are made of infinite folds, and we are actually opening and closing each of our folds at any given moment. And I feel that a book as an architect was just making a composition of containing walls that allowed for infinite ways and scales of space.
How did you choose among the different drawings where to put the words? And what did you try to achieve? I'm sure you wrote more. So like what part of the words you choose to bring into the book and what's left outside on your desk?
I think, again, it's very similar to the world of architecture. It was a process of elimination of precision. And words for me are like architectural details. They're connection, they're connecting. And I tried to put myself as much as I can in the book, but without showing, without limiting myself. In other words, I feel that in every work of art, the more you put yourself out there in more, for lack of a better word, general or more abstract details, the more you can actually touch other people. And that's really almost like kind of the secret for me of the spaces or the architecture, even or the book that I'm making. It's really about the facts. You know, it was just giving the facts in a precise way. And then when you look at the facts and you look at them again and you ask the questions, and you kind of start to take their heart and soul out of them, I think you're able to hand it over to other people, if it makes sense.
Totally.
It's really giving, it's gifting other people. That's how I would say it.
So Ron, there is a story of the birds that are nesting in nature, that you watch them morning after morning. But there is also the story of you as a person like the birds. You are traveling from a place to place since you are an immigrant, you're an Israeli-American, and also there are questions that come to you in the book about questions around language. How do we speak our heart? How can you explain who you are? So I wonder if we can maybe continue to read and then like the next paragraphs and we will talk about that more.
Just in reference to your question, I think I'd read the following paragraphs. I was in the room, lonely even though I wasn't alone. I learned to recognize her voice calling him. They had their own language. I still loved in a foreign language, but I missed my mother's tongue. For love, living in translation became exhausting. It was no longer accurate. Words I was looking for disappeared. End of sentences got swallowed, lost their punctuation marks. Thoughts became simplistic, shallow. So I think language is everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in those sentences that I get, especially the sentence, in particular the sentence for love, living in translation became exhausting. It became when I wrote it a very meaningful sentence for me. Language is culture, and you know, even when I translated this book, or when I tried to begin to translate this book to English, I came to some points where I could not exactly find the right words, or the meaning in the Hebrew language for one word, not even one word, for a letter, became so precise in one hand, and it relates to what we talked about. It was precise in one hand, but it's completely open in the other hand. In other words, this one letter gave it so many meanings. And that one letter, not only that it carried the word or the sentence or the house or the relationship, you know, it brought in the history of the person, the house, the relationship, and it had the potential to hold the future of the relation, the house, or the relationship. And when you need to translate, when there is like a disconnect or there's a mechanism that connects your mind to the heart, as opposed to this almost very natural connection that doesn't need an intervention, it becomes difficult, especially in critical moments. And I think that's what the sentence is trying to convey. And for me, looking at the birds, there was something in their behavior or their relationship or their attitude that had no thought in it. It was just happening.
Mm-hmm. It
was natural. It was flowing. You know, the distance, the gaps between them, they're accurate. Each of them knew what they were doing. There was something so natural in the flow of life in that nest that it made me think of myself. In other words, the more I was looking at them, the more they were looking at me. And I started reading about them, and then I realized that they fly by themselves. And they fly to the equator each by themselves. And I ask myself, well, I was just born. I am talking about the young birds. I was just born, and now I need to fly to the equator. How do I know to get there? And then I realized they have this inner compass that's been there for generations, that tries them, that gives them, that sends them, you know, tells us where to go. It's almost like, you know, we go in biblical terms where God says to Abraham, Lech Lecha. Take your stuff and go. And he goes. You know, he's not questioning. He's not thinking. He's just going. There's an inner compass that guides you. And I think that's one of the gifts they gave me, is the realization of the belief in the inner compass, you know, or the understanding, or that there is an inner compass that drives us. And not to be afraid of just, you know, opening your wings and flying to wherever this inner compass takes you.
So Rada, I'm thinking about that, and thank you so much for it. I love thinking about home with you specifically because you are an architect. So, and you are an architect who also now look in this book on birds. And I'm thinking about that, how much the nest of the birds is their home, because in a way it's a home that they are going to live. There is a movement with the home. And I'm thinking that in a few weeks, we as Jewish people, we're going to celebrate the holiday of Sukkot, where you are asked to leave your what you think is your home and to make a nest or something, sukkah, outside of your home to remember. So normally we interpret it that you need to remember that many people do not have home. But when I read your book and as I'm listening to you, maybe we need to leave our what we call home and to be in another home in nature in order to understand that home is not about then maybe a home demands movement.
It's very beautiful what you're saying, because I do believe that a real concept actually requires two opposites.
Mm-hmm.
In a sense, in order for the most stable, or what you think is stable place to become stable, you really need to move. You really need to maybe look at it from a, you know, from a different perspective. It's you know, I go back again to the translation because into language, like we talked about, because you know, in Hebrew there's one word which is bayit. In English, you know, and when I translated it, it was difficult to me sometimes to put the right, and still to put the right word in English. There's house.
Mm-hmm.
There is a house, which is particular house. And then there is home.
Mm.
How do you differentiate between the three? Or my role as an architect is to take house, make it a house, and then make it a home. You know, while in Hebrew, it's all bayit. And you need this other word after that, or, you know, connected to it in order to make it.
What kind of,
you know, and bayit is, you know, we don't think about it, but this body of ours is our bayit, is our home. I'm not sure that we really need the physical home, you know, or be at the physical home, because home is with us. This is like when I write about my mother's tongue. This is when I write about, you know, looking at the horizon here, imagining that one clear day I would see my homeland. It's enough for me, because even if I don't see the homeland, it's there. And I think that's what I learned. You know, the birds, they come back to you every year. And it's okay to get away. It's okay to have that gap of time between, you know, the two homes. And it's okay to have maybe more than one, even, because I think there's so many layers, you know, of existence that we live in. So, That's a lesson they give me. I think the real home is not even physical. You know, I probably thought about it before, but I think the birds emphasize it to me.
And more. I think about that, Ran, that you're saying that home is not about the physical, and then you are an architect who are building and designing places for people and schools and temples, JCCs that you're so as an architect, what happened when you sit there and you need to build something that, you know, will hold the rain and the snow of the northeast, but also you want people to come and feel something. So I wonder if you can take us to a mental journey with you, Ran, who are drawing, but you draw also houses and homes and buildings.
Yeah. So I think the first thing I would like to do when I take you to this journey, yes, is take out the word architectural or structural from this journey. Okay. My role, and this is the way I see it, my role as an architect is to connect. And what I connect are intimacies. I connect your intimacy to the world outside. I connect my intimacy to the world outside, right? If I'm able to make spaces that connect intimacy, then I succeeded. You know, it goes back to, I think, the pivotal sentence or the pivotal sentence in the book, where I say, talk about the male building his nest with the wall of his heart, right? Now, in English, it says building the nest with the wall of his heart. In Hebrew, if I don't, it says Bekir Libo. Be, the word, the letter, Bekir Libo, means that he built his house with the wall of his heart, but he also built his house in the wall of his heart. I can't find, there is no word in English that can describe, that can actually to put those two together. Here I have this one letter, which by the way starts the whole Torah, that puts everything together, right? And so the making of this intimacy, how do you make intimacy? How do you connect intimacy? You find the right way and then you disappear. Because real intimacy needs to be found by the own individual. You know, and when I'm an architect, it's a conversation, it's a dialogue. It's just me conversing with the birds. You know, I bring myself in, but I have to bring myself in a way that almost that makes me disappear. You know,
and, well, you know, there is a Jewish midrash, which is like an old interpretation, and it says that it asks the question: when God gave the Ten Commandments or the five books of Moses, where exactly God is in the world? Like, is God in the demanding from the people? And the mystics, the Jewish mystics, they say that God is in between the letters, in the nothing that is there. This is where, because if God will be in the letters, it will not be the book for the people. It will be the book of God. And if and there is something about the between, that this is where the architect sits.
So this is, I mean, this is very, very beautiful what you're saying. You know, this actually, it sounds abstract, but it's really the theory of materials. Mm. If you take two materials and you put them one next to each other, for the most part, most of the time, you need kind of an interstitial space in between them, or an interstitial material, which will allow them to expand and contract. In their own temperature, in their own time, in their own pace, right? So they have room to grow, to expand and contract. If you put them right next to each other, and they will break, right? It's the same with human beings. It's exactly the same with human beings, and it's exact with language. We talked about movement. In order to think for things to move, you need space. You need air. You need that gap. If things are too tight, they're not able to move. If buildings are built too tight, they're not they will start to crack. They will start to break. We need that gap. It's exactly that gap that you're talking about between the letters, you know, that is making everything stand. And so in that sense, it's where all the worlds are, you know, like, are connected. You know, and it's very beautiful. It's but it's really about us. It's really about us.
You know, one of my favorite things when I have my godfather, he lives in Vermont in an old house and wood house, and one of I love sitting there, being there, during the winter when the wood moves because of the heating inside and the cold outside, and you hear the house speaks in a way between.
I agree that this is a house. For me, a house is a living organism. It has birth, it has death, and you have to accept that it has life. A house, you know, I feel I'm happy to come to my house here in Connecticut where I am now, but I know that the house is happy when I'm coming here. The house wants me in here. He wants me, he wants my family, he wants the people I love to be in here. You know, that it makes him happy. It makes him grow. It makes him feel better. You know, it's just like a relationship for me between a house and a person are similar to a relationship between a person and a person. In a house, you need to take care of a house, you know, just like you need to take care of your friend or people you love. We can talk about the windows of the house that are the eyes of the house. We can talk about the doors of the house that are the mouth of the house. And it's, and in that sense, just to close the thought that we talked before about house, a house and a home, the word nest, which in Hebrew was a ken, is an amazing word. It became like an amazing word for me, you know, because it put the birds and me in the same house. Mm-hmm. They gave me a house. They really gave me a house, you know. In that sense, it's just a small anecdote. 2 weeks ago, we were sitting here outside, and this year, for some reason, everything happened earlier. So the birds arrived earlier and left earlier. There was only one osprey left in the last couple of weeks. And on Saturday around noon, he came and he flew and he stood on a roof very close to us. Very, very close. He never comes so close, never. He came, he stood on a roof very, very close. We looked at it. I ran to get the binoculars. Everybody looked at it. I told them, I knew it. I told him he came to say goodbye. He stood there for half an hour. He then, kind of just flew above us. And sure enough, the next morning, he was not there. He was gone.
I love him.
He knows that. He knows me. They know me. They know me. I really believe so. And we have a connection, you know.
It's beautiful. And then in the book, there is this part that we need to add it to your story, that you also served at the IDF, the Israeli Army, for many years as a navigator in helicopters, which make you and the relation between you and birds very realistic. I mean, you think about space, not only as me, as someone who is walking on the ground, but you spend, I'm sure, hours, 100 hours above, like a bird, and next to birds.
Hopefully not too close.
Hopefully not too close. Can you bring us a little bit about this? What happened to a human being when you spend so many hours as a bird, when you think about space?
I think, and it relates to architecture, a little less on the method of navigating, in particular, more in helicopters, but also in fighters jets, is that you have a map. Right now, you don't have maps. You have the instruments that show you where you are, but you have a map. So you look at the map to see where you are. You look right underneath you to make sure that you're in the place that you want to be. I mean, listen to the language. It's so nice. It's how it relates to everything. You look underneath to see where you are, and you compare it to the map. And you also look at the clock, because you drew your path with minutes, so you know where you are. But then at the same time, you have to lift your eyes and you have to look at the horizon.
Mm.
Because if you won't look at the horizon, the plane would crash. You need to have a reference to the horizon at all times. So you look underneath you where you are, and then you look at the horizon. You look underneath you, you look at the horizon, you look at the clock, and so on, and so goes, and goes on and on all the time. So it's a constant comparison of where you are and looking at the horizon, where you are and looking at the horizon. And that what allows you to kind of be able to control the three-dimensional space that you are all the time. It's that looking at the moment and looking at the horizon, looking at the moment and looking at the horizon. And that was a big lesson for me also when I became an architect, because you have an initial idea, which is the horizon. You have to, at all during the process of making, go back time after time to the essence, to the initial idea. Otherwise, you can crash.
Mm. Metaphorically and physically.
Yeah, metaphorically and physically. Otherwise, you can crash. And then the other difference that you have in the air, which we don't have here on the ground, is, which always fascinated me, is you can't stop. You can't say for a second, hey, I need to stop. You know, and everything stops. It never stops. It's constant movement. They teach you in the Air Force that when there's doubt, there's no doubt. In other words, if something goes wrong, if you feel, not even see, but if you feel that something is wrong, that probably something is wrong, then look around and try to find what's wrong and fix the problem. I took it and in the process of making, turn it around, because when you make, you create, you plan a building, a space, you write a sentence. I all the time feel, I ask myself, is it right or is it wrong? Is it right or is it wrong? Until you suddenly have that feeling that you feel there's no doubt, it's right. It's right there. And then you move on. So you change it. And then the last thing about this question of flying, when you fly long distances, you need to look at things in one scale. You don't need to see all the details. But when you come at 150 knots and you need to find a well, which is basically 5 feet by 5 feet, you need to change the scale of the map. You need to see many more details. You need to see exactly the creek that goes. You need to see the turn in the path, you know, that you need to understand the land, the details of the land. It's the same in architecture. You have a great idea, you make a sketch. The closer you go, the closer you get to the building, the larger the scale becomes to resolve all the details. And then just when the helicopter lands on the ground and now the map is kind of irrelevant because the scale is 1:1, that's what happens in a building. Now you enter into a building, which is the scale of a human being. So it's all this play of scales that you learn.
And how do you do a pose when you fly? And in a way, you are not allowed to have pose because there are no poses.
Well, in a helicopter, you can pose. You can hover. In a helicopter, you can hover.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hovering is a wonderful condition because hovering is an equilibrium. All forces are equal. It's a great question that you ask because it's also a lesson for life. You can hover after, you know, the first time they teach you to hover, you need a football field because the plane goes all over. And slowly you're going to control everything until you just basically take the three wheels of the helicopter and you bring the helicopter into a standstill. And now you're in equilibrium. It is very interesting that when you hover, you can take all wheels and shift them very fast. The helicopter will go up and down, but it wouldn't move. Mm-hmm. And it's a great lesson that when you can move things rapidly without thinking it's not, but still you would stay in the same place. So you probably should not do it. But yes, you can hover in one place. Yeah.
Ryan, your book is, for me, as I opened, is a little bit to redefine what the book is. It's also what space is and how language is play among them. Because the book, you open with not finding your language. But I think by the birds, you learn that by being, there is something with the body, with the physicality, that in a way our home and many ways, the language. And I just like it that you mentioned the letter, that it's a confused letter in Hebrew, be, and just this letter itself, the word of the letter is bite, be,
right.
And this beautiful game in the between. So Ran, thank you so much for your book, and thank you so much for joining us as a New Books Network.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the opportunity.